This is a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Commission on the Judiciary will come to order. The Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie, Heideprin, Schmidt,
here.
Trubeck Berry,
here.
Valley,
here.
Teason,
here.
Abdallah,
here. We have a quorum. Just to remind everybody, turn off your cell phones. Register at the podium if you plan on testifying. And the chair will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the last meeting.
So
we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve the minutes of the last meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes of the last meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. We have a full agenda today, so we'll move right along. We'll start with Senate Bill 186, provide for the imposition of a late payment fee for unpaid child support. Senator Olson.
Timeliness of the morning, I apologize if you haven't had an opportunity to read that. It's a pretty extensive amendment to the bill, and I guess what I would start, and I'm sure that all of you are smart enough to read as you listen, so I would tell you the reason for me bringing the bill before you today on Senate Bill 186. We have, it's a constituent issue, and it's a constituent issue not just for me, but for everyone on this panel. We have a problem with the way that non-custodial, self-employed guardians or non-guardians are paying their support. A non-custodial parent that doesn't have physical custody of the children and is self-employed, the Department of Social Services doesn't garnish that wage. And so if I work at Angus Palm or at Morell's or at Gale Manufacturing for $10 or $12 an hour welding all day, the department can have with a judgment filed, can go ahead and take a wage garnishment right out of my check. If I'm a self-employed professional, and that means, you know, we've got CPAs, we've got farmers, we've got chiropractors and attorneys that are self-employed, they don't go in and garnish those wages. And we have quite a few instances where those people are gaming the system. And so this bill is an attempt to put some teeth in it for those custodial parents that actually pay their bills on time. And the first draft that you had was simply a non-attorney version of trying to say what I meant to say without knowing how to exactly say it. And so this version, I've had about four different attorneys take a look at this and help me with the language to put it into a format that I hope is acceptable to the committee and certainly would accept any constructive or negative criticisms on the bill. What we're trying to do is these people, and when I'm talking about these people, I'm talking about people that are smarter than the average Joe, are gaming the system whereby if their child support's due on the first of the month, and it comes down to, you know, paying for the suburban and the house payment or paying the custodial parent, that seems to be an easy one to me. I'm not going to pay the custodial parent because I know that I can stretch this thing out for about 88 days or 3 months right to the doorstep of where the Department of Social Services will catch up with me and take me to court, and then I'll make a partial payment and have them off my back for another 3 months. But at the same time, the custodial parent hopefully is paying their bills on time. There's instances, you know, Senator Trubeck Berry and I talked about hearsay testimony, how much we both dislike that. So I'm going to give you a for instance rather than, you know, this gal in Madison told me. But think about this for an example. If I'm a custodial parent and I have my checking account set up to take my car payment and my mortgage and my student loan and my visa taken out of there every month, hoping that the non-custodial parent will do the right thing and pay their bill on time, and then that person decides not to. Well, there's the opportunity right there for five different overdrafts if the money isn't there for the custodial parent. So we're really allowing the non-custodial parent to use the custodial parent as a line of credit. And what this bill does is, you know, we define in Section 1, you know, what is chronically delinquent. And in order to say that I don't want to create a bunch of undue work. DSS is overloaded the way it is. And so what we wanted to do was to define what exactly is a delinquent person. And so Section 1 actually defines how long it takes, you know, with the five or more days after the child support's due, and they have to pay, you know, less than 90%. So it takes away that gaming part of it. Like I said, they'll pay a portion of what's due to buy them more time. And then in Section 2, once we have the chronically delinquent obligor, the late payment fee, we actually put this back on the custodial parent. It's not going to be something where DSS is going to have a trigger mechanism where this will be an automatic payment. The custodial parent will have to actually do some of the work themselves and go down and file a statement that shows that the payments haven't been received. And what we've done here, instead of saying that it's, you know, 3 months in a row, we're saying it's 3 months in any 12-month period that they've been delinquently late, that they have the ability to go down and with notice to the non-custodial parent to say, hey, you haven't been paying. I'm going to put this judgment against you if you don't come to terms with the amount ordered here. And so it allows for the window for them to give notice, which I believe is important, to that non-custodial parent. And at the same time, there's some teeth in this where we have, you know, 10% of the court-ordered amount or $50, whichever is greater. Section 3 is where the obligor can petition. So if there's a wrongly filed notice or a judgment against the non-custodial parent, they can actually go in and have that vacated from their record. We don't want to have some at the same time where I believe the non-custodial parent was probably the person in charge of the finances and they're still using this as ability to control the custodial parent. I don't want the custodial parent to use this mechanism as some type of a vendetta to go out and try to harm the non-custodial parent's credit. And then in Section 4, we actually have it where the where the actual notice has to be provided to the non-custodial parent that they're going to file this judgment with the clerk of courts. I, like I said in my opening statement, I'm not an attorney. I've never played one on TV, and so I would ask for your input and would stand by for questions. I believe that there may be other people willing to help me out with some testimony as to why this is needed and why it's a good step towards bringing some people that are gaming our system back into compliance. And with that, I'll stand by for you.
Any questions for Senator Olson? Senator Gillespie.
Senator Olson, how many states are imposing a late fee? And just for purposes of efficiency, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask a stacked question. And then for those states, especially our neighboring states, what is the late fee and how do they determine it?
With due respect, I would defer that to someone with the department. I don't know. I haven't done the bordering states to see what they're doing. What I said with the penalty and with the way that we set this up was I just conferred with some other attorneys on what would be workable and fair at the same juncture. So I'd apologize if I...
Further questions? And then thank you, Senator Olson. Other proponents? Other proponents of Senate Bill 186. Good morning, Mr. Walter.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Terry Walter. I'm the director for the Division of Child Support in the Department of Social Services. And we support this bill. I think it gives custodial parents an opportunity to prevent some of the gaming, as Senator Olson had indicated, that may be going on. and I think it gives them a remedy for that.
Can you answer Senator Gillespie's question?
I don't have that data with me. I could probably find out and provide that to the committee if they so choose.
Further questions? Thank you. Other proponents? Proponents. Do we have opponents? Senate Bill 186. Opponents. Seeing none, the public hearing on 186 is closed for committee discussion and or action. Senator Gillespie.
Okay.
Mr. Wilder.
Terry, I'm no mathematician. So tell me, in a one-year period, what that 10%, would that be 110% interest if they were penalized at the maximum 10% for a year? Would that be 110% interest?
It would be 10% of each payment. If for example, if the non-custodial parent is ordered to pay $700 a month, if they become late three times during a 12-month period, then the 10% applies to each of the monthly payments that they were delinquent on or chronically delinquent, determined to be. So it would be $70. For each of the monthly payments that was late. They may have made 9 payments on time, which the late payment fee would not apply to, but the 3 that they were delinquent on or late, then the 10% would apply to those monthly payments.
So, Mr. Chairman, follow up. 10% a month, would that be 120% a year interest? Is that right?
Well, this is a penalty, I guess. It's not necessarily interest, I guess.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if it was interest, what I want is the per annum amount. If it was 10% a month, what is the per annum amount for that? Can you tell me that? Is that 120%? No?
I don't know.
Okay. I have another question, Mr. Chairman. So, Terry, you and I had some conversations about self-employment issues with child support.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a policy matter, what I'm wondering is, this is just applying a penalty for being late.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really getting after those individuals who are taking money under the table or sheltering income. So to say that we're targeting self-employment, we're hitting everybody here, isn't that right?
Yes, potentially we could apply it to anyone. Those individuals that may be employed but working on, you know, cash under the table and so forth, it would apply to those individuals as well.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Durback-Barrett-Terry.
Well, and maybe this should have been for Senator Olson, but as I read through it, I'll note that in Section 3, it says the obligor has the burden of showing an inability to timely pay any delinquent payment. Clearly, the intent is that if someone has a genuine inability, the court may vacate the judgment. My question is, do you mean to limit the mechanism of having the court vacate the judgment only to those cases where the defense is inability to pay? I would think not. I would think if the defense is she's wrong, those, you know, I wasn't late, that the court would also have the right to vacate it.
Yes.
Am I correct? All right. I just know I guess when we're done, we probably need to make a little amendment to the language then if that's the case, but I'll bring that up later. So.
Further questions? Senator Gillespie.
I have to apologize, Mr. Chairman. I do have another question for Senator Olson.
Senator Olson.
Senator Olson, when you referenced that you're trying to target an issue that's an issue for all of our constituents. Are you referring specifically, and did this all start with the self-employment issue that I referenced with Mr. Walter in terms of underreporting income or, you know, hiding income? Is that your major concern here?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator. That's a great question. The main issue here was something that I wasn't even aware of until we had a Cracker Barrel, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, "What can you do about this?" And I didn't understand how – I did not know that if someone was a CPA or a chiropractor or whatever, deemed themselves self-employed, that the state didn't just go in. As a former non-custodial parent, I assumed that everyone in the state was treated the same, that they came in and grabbed the chunk of money for my support that was owed through the judgment, and I didn't realize there was an ability for someone to say that because they were self-employed that they had a special status where they could pay as they saw fit. And so that's where the targeting for this is for, I want to make that clear, is that it is for those people that have the ability to pay. They're driving, you know, $55,000 Suburbans, living in $300,000 houses, and then they choose not to pay, and therefore putting it back on the custodial parent to find a way to bridge the gap on those finances.
Other questions? Thank you, Senator. Committee hearing is closed for, the public hearing is closed for committee discussion and or action. Senator Valley.
I'll move the amendment 186JA.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second to move amendment 186JA. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of 186JA say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? 186 is amended with 186JA. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Tribbett.
I would move a further amendment. In Section 3, the fourth line, that line begins, an inability. I would move to amend that to any alleged inability. So strike the word, well, I guess add a Y to the word and insert the word alleged.
We have an amendment on Section 3 of the amendment, 186JA, to add a Y on line 4, Section 3, add a Y to and to make it any, and then add the word alleged inability. Any discussion, any questions on that? Senator Gillespie.
I just have a question for Senator Tribbett, and maybe more in the line of a comment. Senator Tribbett, I see what you're attempting to do here, and my only concern is that the statement isn't what the obligor is. It's not the... what that sentence is stating is the burden. And so would a burden be alleged? It seems to me that the burden would be the inability to pay, and certainly the obligor would allege that they have the inability to pay, but would we want to do that when it states the burden?
I'm not sure I understand your question. To start with, the concern with the language as it is literally says that anybody coming in to contest the petition has to prove an inability to pay. That makes no sense, since some people coming in to contest the penalty might not be alleging that at all. They might be alleging that it's factually incorrect what was represented to the court. So it seems to me that that the only time the obligor has the burden of showing an inability to pay is if the obligor has alleged to that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to wordsmith with you, Nancy, but it seems to me that inability should, that language should stay the same, and then if there are any other causes to have relief from the judgment, then we should state that.
that would probably be a better fix. I was looking for, the shortest and cheapest one. But exactly. I mean, my only concern is, of course, that we not unintentionally put an irrelevant burden on the person who's coming in defending against this judgment. But I would certainly yield if you've got some other language in mind, Senator.
Senator Teason.
I'm just wondering if this section is simply talking about the ability to pay. Aren't we expanding this to talking about whether they should be paying or not? Wouldn't that require a separate hearing to determine if the amount is wrong or?
That's not what we're talking about. And from the sponsor, I understand the intent is not to have this section talk only about the inability to pay. Section 3 is intended to protect some rights of the person who's paying the child support. So that, for example, if I went in and alleged that you'd been late for the last 10 months, but in fact you're saying I wasn't late a single month, you would have a right to come in and contest it. As drafted, however, Section 3 only refers to a right, essentially a right to contest, or it implies that the only right you have is if you can show inability to pay. And that's what we're talking about here, is what the showing is that someone would have to make to come in, not to deny the obligation to pay, but to deny the claim that you were late. Make sense?
I've got reservations, but another lawyer wants to come in and give his opinion.
We won't charge you for any of this, sir.
This one here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Barnett, State Bar. We do not have an official position on this, but we were part of the drafting process to help. I think I can address Senator Turbuck-Berry's question. If you look at Section 3, and then the first sentence says that the obligor may petition the court, but it doesn't restrict the petition to any particular grounds. And then if you go to the last sentence, if the court determines that, and at that point I think you can put that there was no delinquent payment or that the delinquency was caused by the inability to pay, I think we've covered your concern, because the court could cover both the factual determination, was it delinquent or was it not, and if it was delinquent, then it would be the inability to pay. So I think if you're looking for the appropriate place to put that language, and I agree with you that it probably should be put in there, I think that's where it would go.
A question for Mr. Barnett, if I might.
Go ahead.
So if we stated in that last full sentence of Section 3, if the court determines, and then insert, no delinquency exists, or, and then go on to say that any delinquent payment was caused by the inability?
I think that works, Senator.
Okay. Senator Turbuck-Berry. Okay. Do you want to withdraw your amendment?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Senator Gillespie, do you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have an amendment in Section 3. The last full sentence that starts with, if the court determines, after determines, insert that no delinquency exists or.
That no delinquency exists. Or. If the court determines that no delinquency exists, or payment was caused by that any delinquent payment was caused by inability?
Yes.
Is there a second? We have a motion and second to amend 186JA as noted. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? 186J is amended in Section 3. In some committee, you know. All right. Further discussion on 186 as amended. Further discussion or action on 186 as amended. We have a moved a motion to pass. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and second to do pass on 186, Senate Bill 186 as amended. Further discussion? Seeing none. Those in favor, 186 as amended, signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie?
Aye.
Heideplin? Schmidt?
Aye.
Turbeck Berry?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Keeson?
Aye.
Abdallah?
Aye. 7-0. 186. We'll go to the floor on a 7-0 vote. Senator Adelstein is not here. This bill has been deferred twice. Pardon?
Thank you.
We're going to give him one more chance. House Bill 1021, provide for a contested case hearing on the denial of a claim for recovery of an alleged overpaid tax, penalty, or interest. That would go. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Fergal with the Department of Revenue and Regulation. House Bill 1021 is an act for a contested case hearing on the denial of a claim for recovery of an allegedly overpaid tax, penalty, and interest. Now, the reason for the bill that we bring before you today is that currently SDCL 10-59-22 states that the Secretary's determination of the amount of the overpayment recoverable is for the purposes of judicial review, a final decision in a contested case. Therefore, if a person currently wants to appeal a denial of a refund by the department, they have to appeal directly to the circuit court. The problem with the procedure that's in place now is that when this goes to the circuit court, other than a letter from the department stating that a person's request for a refund for these types of things is denied, there is no record for which the circuit court can make a determination about whether the department's determination was correct. And what's been happening is the circuit court has been remanding these things back to the department to develop an administrative record so they can appropriately decide the administrative appeal then. And so what we're trying to do with this bill is to streamline the process and provide for an administrative hearing up front so that somebody who's contesting a denial for these types of refunds up front has a record from which they can appeal, and that the circuit court has a record for which they can decide the appeal. This is the way the department's handles many matters that come before it, including assessments on audits. This would provide for the same type of administrative hearing that people who are audited and want to contest the audit have today. So basically what this bill does is streamline the process and give people an administrative hearing up front, and then if they want to appeal any denial or appeal the decision, if it's not favorable at the administrative level, they can appeal it to the circuit court, and then from there to the Supreme Court if there continues to be an unfavorable decision. but there would be an appropriate record from which to appeal, and that's the purpose of the bill.
Any questions? Senator Valley.
How does that happen now? Is the administrative decision final now, or the secretary's decision, is it final?
Yes, pursuant to SDCL 10-59-22, it says that his determination of the amount of overpayment or lack thereof is final for the purposes of judicial review. So what a person has to do then is appeal that decision directly to circuit court. And because they appeal it to circuit court, and basically there's just a letter by the department, when the circuit court receives that appeal, they're looking at a letter and saying, I don't have enough information to make a judicial determination about whether or not the department was correct in its denial. And therefore, they remand it back to the department to develop a record.
Further questions, Senator Trebek, or Senator Valley, do you have a follow-up?
So we've got another layer in between then, is that the, if I may, Mr. Chairman? We've got another layer in between, and we have an administrative judge that makes a determination after the secretary. I'm just trying to put the new order in place.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Yes, it seems to be an unnecessary layer there. What happens is that instead of requesting an administrative hearing, they have to appeal directly to circuit court. The circuit court gets that appeal, and then they remand it back to the department to develop a record, basically by holding an administrative hearing, from which then the person that wants to appeal can then go back to the circuit court and ask the circuit court to make a judicial determination based on that record.
Further questions? Senator Valley, one follow-up. Oh, Senator Beckberry.
Sir, are you aware of any reason why 10-59-22 was set up that way in the first place as obviously a deviation from the normal administrative procedures route?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Turbachberry, I don't have any knowledge about why it was done that way. It seems to be an oversight when I look at it.
Also, you said what's been happening is the circuit courts are sending it back for an administrative hearing, notwithstanding the absence in the statute of a provision calling for it. Has that happened on more than one occasion? I guess I got a two-part question. Are we talking about something that has happened repeatedly? And secondly, are there circuit courts that indeed are proceeding on the merits without sending it back for a remanded hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Turbachberry, we currently have a case right now that is going through the process. And basically what we've done is the department and the people with the lawyers that are representing the appellants is we've stipulated that this could be remanded back to the department to have a hearing and to develop a record, but it has happened before. We don't get very many of these types of cases where people are appealing a request for a refund. A lot of times these things are taken care of during audits, or if there is just an obvious error, then we would pay the refund back and there wouldn't be an appeal. But where there is a disagreement, then this has been problematic.
And to your knowledge, the circuit courts never proceed on their own with a hearing de novo?
Mr. Chairman, I have not been aware of a time where they have.
Further questions? Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not aware of the process and now where the secretary makes a determination versus the administrative hearing. Would that put an additional burden on the taxpayer? Is there going to be expenses incurred by the taxpayers? Do you have to hire a lawyer for one and not for the other or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Teason, I think this bill helps streamline the process. I think right now, if you would – if you were somebody who requested a refund of the department and the department denied that refund, you would want to go get an attorney, and that attorney would want to appeal that directly to circuit court, because they wouldn't want to have to deal with a jurisdictional issue later on. For instance, your attorney and my attorney could agree that we'd hold an administrative hearing, and then we go ahead and hold that administrative hearing without you going directly to circuit court. But then once it gets to circuit court, if there's an unfavorable decision for you at the circuit court, as we all know, jurisdiction can be raised by the courts at any time, and the circuit court could say, well, listen, you were supposed to appeal directly to me, and now your time has passed, and so you're out of luck. I don't have any jurisdiction to hear this case, and that's something that we don't want to happen. So we think it actually would save, you know, taxpayers money if they can have the administrative appeal up front, develop a record, and then if there's an unfavorable decision, they can go ahead and appeal to the circuit court, as opposed to this having to be appealed to the circuit court, then it get remanded back to the department, hold a hearing. If there's an unfavorable decision, then you got to go back to the circuit court and follow the process through. We think this eliminates a step.
Further questions? Thank you, Andy. Are there other proponents of House Bill 1021? Proponents? Are there opponents to 1021? Opponents? Seeing none, the public hearing on 1021 is closed for committee discussion and or action. Motion and second on 1021 do pass. Any discussion?
Sure.
Senator Turbeck Berry.
For the benefit of the non-lawyers, and I hope Senator Gillespie or Heideprim will correct me if I'm misstating this, as I don't practice in the world of administrative law, but what this bill would do would be to just essentially apply the same routine that is done in virtually all, if not all, administrative law contested cases, which is that you have a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. Well, first you get an adverse ruling from the department head, then you have an administrative law judge hearing, and then that is appealed to the circuit court, which functions as an appellate court at that time. And so that's just the way it ordinarily would go in most administrative law contests.
Do you two agree? The other 25 lawyers in the audience agree? Further discussion? Those in favor of House Bill 1021? If they think things are going along pretty good. You're out of order. 1021, those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie, Heideprim, Schmidt, Turbeck Berry, Valley, Teason, Abdallah.
All right. 7-0, 1021. Is Representative Ingalls, House Bill 1110. House Bill 1110 repeals certain provisions relating to limited liability for Y2K litigation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Rich Ingalls from District 9 in Hartford, and I told Senator Gant he was off the hook for this morning. So, this bill, House Bill 1110, is one of about six bills that I've brought this year repealing different things on the books that I think are outdated. This particular chapter is on Y2K litigation. And as the year 2000 approached, everybody thought all the computers were going to crash. So the legislature put this on the books to deal with a situation where people had tried to minimize the problems with the anticipated crash of everybody's computers, and to deal with the lawsuits that would arise from that. But as we know, the computers never did crash, and there was little, if any, Y2K litigation. And this is one of those chapters that was a prophylactic measure that turned out to be never needed. So I propose that we repeal it, and I would stand by for any questions.
Senator Teason. Education.
Thank you, Representative. Are you sure that you want to repeal this? Why not amend it to Y3K, and then we'll be ready?
I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Never mind.
Further questions? Further questions? Senator Valley.
This would have no effect on any litigation that may be out there if there was any problems or anything appears now?
I would suggest that if anything were to appear now, it would be outside of the statute of limitations anyway.
Further questions? Thank you, Representative Ingalls. Are there other proponents? Are there other proponents? Are there opponents? Are there opponents? Senator Trebek-Berry. I thought you raised your hand. The public hearing on 1110 is closed for committee discussion and or action. We have a motion to pass, seconded by Senator Schmidt. Any discussion? Seeing none. Those in favor of do pass on House Bill 1110 signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie, aye. Heidegren, aye. Schmidt, aye. Trebek-Berry, aye. Valley,
aye.
Teason,
aye.
Abdallah,
aye. We have a motion for consent, seconded by Senator Teason. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? 1110 will go on the consent calendar. Judith Roberts, is this yours, 1086? Let's take that now. House Bill 1086. Senator Gillespie.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, there's a pending amendment that we never acted on regarding on 1086, and it is to insert, it was regarding the accrued and daily interest, Mr. Chairman, and if I can get to the bill, I can refresh my memory. Poor Ruben is getting tired of babysitting me.
Hey.
Everything appears in on page 6 of your minutes from the 10th.
Mr. Chairman, it was page 1, line 9, regarding adding in and accrued. So the line would read amount that is owed on judgment. And daily and accrued interest. Probably got one too many ands in there, but it's been moved and seconded already. So,
does everybody understand that?
Do you need me to restate?
Any questions? Okay, Senator Gillespie moves an amendment. Is there a second? Senator Gillespie moves, and then we have a second to amend 1086 on line 9, amount that is owed on judgment and daily and accrued interest, correct? Any discussion? Those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? 1086 is amended. Proponents of 1086. Oh, there's still a pending amendment. Pending amendment. Any discussion on that? Senator Gillespie.
So, Ruben, didn't we just amend the pending amendment? Isn't that what we did?
Yes, you amended the pending amendment. So now you have a pending amended amendment that you have to act on.
Well, I would move that pending amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and second on the pending amended amendment. Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the pending amended amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed? I'm not going to say it again.
Mr. Chairman, I have another amendment.
Senator Gillespie.
It's line 15, and the what I'm asking is that you strike an agreement that the court order, and then after surplus, insert shall. So line 15 then would read that any surplus shall be returned to the defendant.
Any discussion on that? Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
The committee will remember at the last meeting there was some concern about the wording about an agreement that the court order, and so this just clears up to solidify that the plaintiff's attorney needs to state affirmatively that any surplus be returned to the defendant and strike that other language.
Further questions? Comments? Those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 1086. Proponents. Proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judith Roberts. I'm legislative and legal counsel for the UJS. I'm here on behalf of the Chief Justice to testify on 1086. I'm just here to say that we consider those amendments friendly amendments, and we're fine with how the bill stands as presently amended. Thank you.
Any questions from Ms. Roberts? Thank you. Other proponents? Are there other proponents? And then are there opponents to 1086 as amended? Opponents? And then the public hearing on 1086 is closed for committee discussion and or action. Senator Gillespie moves, do pass as amended. Is there a second? Senator Valley. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of House Bill 1086 as amended signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. The Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie?
Aye.
Heidefren?
Aye.
Schmidt?
Aye.
Jervac Ferry?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Thiessen?
Aye.
Abdallah?
Aye. 7-0 on 1086. That leaves us with Senate Bill 146 and Senate Bill 148. Now, as far as Senate Bill 148 is concerned, I'm going to defer it until Thursday. This is the third time it's been deferred. And if there's no action, there are no proponents Thursday, I'm going to take some kind of other action, probably to table it. That leaves Senate Bill 146. We've sent for Senator Gerstedt. She said she'd be here in a few minutes, so the committee can be at ease for a few minutes. Committee will come back to order. We have Senate Bill 146, increase the penalty for solicitation of a minor. Senator Gerstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to you, sir, and members of the committee. Sandy Gerstedt, Senator District 12, and I apologize for making you all wait. I was over in education for an important vote over there. And I won't take but more than a few minutes of your time here. The impetus for this bill began last fall when I read about the police in Sioux Falls conducting a chat with online predators. One thought he was emailing a 13-year-old and arranged to meet her in the park to have sex. Instead, he was met by the police, who arrested him for solicitation of a minor for sex. The police and the prosecutor were disappointed that they couldn't get him put away for a longer period of time. The punishment for solicitation is a felony, class six felony, which is up to 2 years in time. I was interviewed by Kello about the case, and I said I thought the law should perhaps be changed to get up to speed with internet solicitation. A judge wrote to me and said the law was okay, but the punishment should be class four felony instead of six, so that there could be a longer sentence, potential longer sentence. I thought that might have been a good idea, that perhaps these folks should be off the street for a longer period of time, so I had a bill drawn up to reflect that. However, I got to thinking about the perpetrator, and I wanted to find out more about that person and about the victim. So with the help of Ann Eichinger, I explored a number of research journals on sexual solicitation of youth. Ann got all this stuff for me, and I've looked through it all and compared with some bills and some laws on the books in other states as well. This quote that I have from the March 2008 edition of the American Psychologist confirmed my suspicions of what happens to the victim of such a crime. Healthy romantic relationships and sexual development are the issues of concern when considering youthful vulnerability to online molesters. This is so for several reasons. First, face-to-face peer relationships are the context in which most youth learn to handle the decisions, emotions, and negotiations of romance and intimacy. The internet initiated sex crimes that are romances from the perspective of young victims typically take place in isolation and secrecy, outside of oversight by peers, family members, and others in the youth's face-to-face social networks. This isolation may lead to relationships that form more quickly, involve greater self-disclosure, and develop with greater intensity than face-to-face relationships among peers. Second, a considerable portion of victims are in their early and mid-adolescence. Few youths of those ages have the mature judgment and emotional self-regulation required to engage in healthy relationships that includes sexual intimacy. Third, youths in their early and mid-teens often struggle with emotional control. When they're drawn into online relationships that include disclosures about sexual matters, the feelings that are generated may be particularly powerful and difficult to handle for youths just beginning to experience sexual desires. Fourth, intense romantic and sexual involvements during early and mid-adolescence are associated with a range of negative outcomes. And finally, early sexual activity is related to a variety of risk behaviors, both sexual, that is multiple partners, older partners, unprotected sex, early pregnancy, and otherwise, substance abuse and delinquency. These bode ill for youths in terms of mental health and academic achievement. In summary, what creates risk for teens online is not innocence about sex. The factors that make youths vulnerable to seduction by online molesters are complex and related to immaturity, inexperience, and the impulsiveness with which some youths respond to and explore normal sex urges. So that's a little bit that I discovered about those children that are involved in online solicitation of sex. And those, most of these articles dealt with the victims. But in order to get a more of a profile of the perpetrators, I called David Finkelhor, a psychologist whose name appeared on every research article that I read. And he gave me the following information. There is no reliable information on the rate at which perpetrators offend, but the estimate, reoffend, is about 15 to 20%. So it's not high, I mean, relatively speaking. The most dangerous perpetrators are those who molest prepubescent children or who have social problems. Generally, online perpetrators do not have persistent social problems. While online sexual solicitation of minors is a serious crime, sentence lengths do not appear to be a deterrent and don't necessarily protect the public. It is important to remember that while approximately 50 to 60,000 online solicitors are arrested each year, most are not dangerous predators. Judges can probably do more good by handing out long probations so they can keep track of them and their behavior. And parenthetically, this is what indeed happened to the online perpetrator in Sioux Falls. He was handed a 5-year probation and will be closely monitored. This is a crime that people don't understand. There's a great need for education for children and parents, plus awareness and training for law enforcement and prosecutors. There needs to be more education in schools and around computer sites after school. This is where we could best spend our energy and money. So, Mr. Chair and committee, because of what I've discovered, I would like you to table my bill, and I hope that we can direct more funds toward education in the future.
Thank you. The motion table?
So moved. Thank you, Senator Tristan.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll
second. That's a motion to a motion and a second to table. There's no discussion. All in favor of tabling signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie?
Aye.
Heidefrim? Schmidt?
Aye.
Sherbeck-Berry?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Eason?
Aye.
Abdallah?
Aye. Senate Bill 146 is tabled.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and again, I apologize for...
No further business. The Chair, Leonard... Whoop. Senator Gillespie. Senate Bill 186. All right. Say that again. There's a second. A motion and a second to amend the Senate Bill 186 as stated. Those in favor say aye. Those aye. Now, the Chair will entertain a motion to adjourn. We have a motion and seconded by Senator Heideprim to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned.